Welcome back to another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events. And today we've got a really fun episode with Mark Douglas, who was an investigative reporter for 40 years. He is credited with uncovering government corruption, finding government waste, putting criminals away. Those are actually the articles that are written about him because of his investigative reporting that he's done for all these years. It has had such an effect on so many different cases. And he's going to come in and talk today about one of the serial killers that he covered for over 30 years, as well as how reporters and televised trials and media all affects the criminal investigations and the trials that follow most of those criminal investigations. It's a really fun podcast. So thank you, everybody, for listening in. Keep an eye out for our giveaway. Make sure you're posting on Peter's Proffer to get entered into the drawing for that $25 Amazon gift card giveaway. If you have any questions for us, you can post them on any social media at Tragos Law or send me an email, petertragos@greeklaw.com.
Guest today needs no introduction. If you lived anywhere in Tampa Bay over the last 42 years, you know Mark Douglas. Mark Douglas has been on Eight on Your Side, a WFLA investigative reporter for many, many years. He has broken some of the biggest stories here in our area. I'll share with you all that. Mark has done pieces on a number of cases we've had over the years, has interviewed George and myself and on a number of topics. He is honestly the fairest, most unbiased reporter that I know. Mark will always give you, always at least did.
Even though sometimes he thinks we're the bad guy.
Yeah, no, listen, he always gave everybody a fair shake. He's always did his homework.
Sure.
He's a consummate professional. And on top of just being a reporter for many, many years, Mark is your pilot, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
you're
I am.
Avid sailor, as am I. Yep. And you still teach, you're writing instructor at the University of Tampa. I know that you do some work with some international associations with reporters, mm-hmm. and I think you're coming from a meeting today, I think you told me.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, really, thank you for being here today.
Well, you're welcome. And just to set the record straight, I never think you're bad guys, but I do occasionally think you represent bad guys, and then you help sort that out in court.
It does happen.
But I think even the baddest of the bad deserve a fair and good defense, and certainly they get that through your law firm.
Right, and we feel the same way. So thanks so much for being here, Mark. We're doing a four-part series on serial killers, and we know that you were heavily involved with the media attention for one of the serial killers, Oscar Ray Bolin, for a number of years. So we're going to talk about that, but we're also going to just talk generally about how the media interacts with criminal investigations and cases like that. So when talking about just what your job was as an investigative reporter, when a criminal case would come across your desk, what was your kind of first steps on how you'd cover it, what you would do, and what kind of you would share and what you'd hold closer to the vest for later, maybe?
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, as an investigative reporter, it's every investigative reporter's dream to dig up a crime that law enforcement hasn't already captured the attention of. But in the case of some of these high-profile cases you're talking about, like Oscar Ray Bolin, you know, something like that happens. There's a murder, in this case a series of murders that occurred. And you go out and you cover it like you would any other story as a daily assignment. You gather all the information you can. You talk to police. You look at police records. You speak to neighbors, witnesses. If you can get to the defendant, if the defendant is known, and you can talk to them, which, by the way, drives folks like you crazy when they try to talk to defendants before they face trial. That apparently that's a real sensitive area.
Yeah.
Which I've discussed with other lawyers. I have no shame in trying to do that. But you just try to get the full picture on what happened, how it happened, why it happened, who did what to whom, and maybe even get a feel for what the appropriate consequences should be. And then it goes to trial, and then there's a whole other dimension after that.
Right, and we'll get to that. But in the investigation portion, when law enforcement is investigating it, you're investigating it, how do you determine what you put into stories, what you keep out of stories? Do you, you know, have certain sources you protect, meaning if they tell you something, you won't necessarily run with that? How do you determine kind of what's important for the audience to read when you're doing this type of investigative reporting.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, one of the underlying rules, you know, there is something called journalism ethics. Some people think those two words don't go together, like military intelligence, that sort of thing. But but we do have a code of ethics that we follow. I personally have a code of ethics. And so I think when I'm doing a story that is dramatically affecting people's lives, and especially involving extreme violence and murder, you know, it's important not to do harm when you're trying to inform people. You know, there are certain lines maybe you don't cross. Maybe there were certain other things that happened to family members that are such a sensitive nature, you know, maybe sexual abuse, that sort of thing, that unless it's necessary to bring that into the story, you don't want to harm the victims. You don't want to re-victimize the victims. I certainly never intentionally do that, although inevitably just the fact that these things come up, victims tend to relive what happened. And sometimes it's the defendants that really, their interest, you know, there have been some cases where really high profile, there was a rape case in Tampa that happened, kind of a gang rape kind of thing, several guys, one female victim. It happened in the home of the former publisher of the Tampa Tribune, and it was a very sensitive case, and ultimately the defendant was found to be not guilty of rape and kidnapping, but guilty of some other lesser things. So it was really kind of awkward and odd. Well, is the victim still a rape victim? Is the defendant still a bad guy? I mean, how do you sort all that out? So you just try to do it fairly as best you can, and with an idea that you don't want to harm people unnecessarily.
Yeah, Mark, let me ask, because sure, you've never been afraid of knocking on doors.
Oh, yes, I have been afraid of knocking on doors.
But you still knock on that door.
I still knock on them, yes.
And what I want to know is, for a case, I'm just going to use Oscar A. Bolin for purpose of the conversation, since you followed this guy's case,
yes,
for about 30 years.
That's right.
And what I want to know is, at some point, I'm sure you learned something that was probably of interest to law enforcement, or that law enforcement may have known but had not yet disclosed. What do you do when you get a bit of information, you know, like that? Something that you recognize could be troublesome to law enforcement if this thing goes public.
Well, again, it's not my job to censor or withhold information and to try to figure out, you know, the legal consequences down the road for individuals. I mean, the truth is the truth. And so I think there's a certain obligation to reveal things you find, no matter, you know, let the chips fall where they may, so to speak. You know, in that particular case, I don't recall uncovering anything that would have impacted the law enforcement case. However, until the trial happened, and then I will get to that in a second. But I would say that if I uncovered a piece of evidence, maybe found a, you know, I have found bullet casings and different things like that in the past, and I would, you know, I think we all should be good citizens first. So it's not my job to withhold evidence. So if I came across something that I thought was, you know, important to the legal matter, no matter which way it went, I think it would be my obligation to disclose that either through my reporting and then hand over the evidence if there was evidence, or, you know, whatever I could do to not interfere with the case, but at the same time, you know, be respectful of the boundaries. I don't know if that makes total sense.
Sure, and I think that comes back to kind of the purpose of and what the media's role is in all this, right? Because you joked about how we don't want you guys talking to our clients, which is true, more for our clients' sake, but we realize, just like you said, we have a job to do as criminal defense attorneys. You have a job to do too as the media outlet, because some people, you know, like to bash on the media, but in reality, they have an important role in society, right? So they have a role in letting the people that are not on the inner circle or in the inner circle know what's going on, right? And they have a right to know and read and see what's going on. So, I mean, the media has to be the one to tell them that in an unfiltered way, so that they're not withholding things that are important that, you know, the public may want to know and have a right to know, right? So there is an important aspect of the media's role in any criminal investigation. So, and like you're saying, sometimes you find things that law enforcement doesn't even know about, but other times you're just reporting so that other people can know what's going on in the case if they have interest in it.
Sure. And I will tell you, there have been a number of occasions in my history as a reporter where I've been investigating things and more often than not, things that law enforcement is not even privy to or up to speed on. And, you know, I've I've literally called up the statewide prosecutor and said, look, we've been working on an investigation. It's going to air tonight at 5 or 6 or whatever the case may be. I think it's something you're really going to want to see. And frankly, I think it's in your wheelhouse. And tomorrow I'm going to call you and ask you why you're not doing something about it. So, you know, here's your heads up. And one case in particular that I basically described, that ended up with a state investigation, fraud investigation, and the suspects in that case were arrested, brought to trial, convicted, served time, went to a different state, they're serving time again, and when they're done with that, they're going to go to a third state and probably are going to face trial and, in my view, likely face more time. But in those cases, I sort of worked loosely with law enforcement, but not to the point where I felt like I was compromised in my ethics, or certainly they were compromised.
So have you ever had a situation, I know somebody that had a career like yours later on in your career, I'm sure it was a lot easier to do this than in the beginning, but how did you deal with, you know, sources you weren't sure if what they were telling you was true, or how far would you go with something before you actually put it to paper for the public to read, before you actually fact checked it, you know, as much as you possibly could? Because obviously you can't know without a shadow of a doubt, but I mean, you can do your best discernment before you put something out. How did that work, especially earlier in your career?
Sure. Well, I think you nailed it. Early in my career, it was a little more difficult, especially when you don't have that many sources. And,
right.
You know, people who call you always have an agenda. So to me, it's important to establish, first of all, what are the parameters? You know, how are you, is this on the record? Is this off the record? Can I identify you? Can I not identify you? Do you have any evidence? But, you know, one of the most important questions I ask in that initial conversation is, well, why are you calling me? What's in it for you? You know, what's your motivation? And sometimes the motivation is quite selfish, but that doesn't mean the truth is altered. So, you know, we sort through that. I will tell you that I can't think of a story that I have gone with that was totally based on somebody's allegation that's unsupported by any sort of evidence or documentation or second or third hand confirmation. It's frankly a red flag. It's dangerous. It begs for, you know, a libel suit or slander, and it's just plain wrong to go off half cocked, so to speak, and start broadcasting things that you don't really know to be true or absolutely believe to be true and have some way to support that.
So we've kind of mentioned it already, and when talking about, you know, media's involvement in trial and televised trials and things like that, for it to be more transparent to the public than it used to be, how do you think the media's involvement in having these televised trials, because when you started, I assume they weren't being televised all the time, or was it already being like that when you started?
Yes, it was. I was right there at the beginning, or close to the beginning, when they were being televised.
So when you hear about some of them, or at least I should say when I hear about some of them that were some of the early trials that were televised, you'd see defendants or lawyers or judges acting differently because it was televised by the public. Or, in the Ted Bundy's case, you know, people wrote about how he would put on for the cameras and act a certain way or try to make the judge look bad because he knew the media was listening, and he really played to his audience throughout his case and had such a following and groupies and things like that. How do you feel that's kind of affected, I don't know if I want to say the integrity of inside the courtroom, because I don't think it does now, but maybe when it first started or early on, how do you think that affected things?
I think there were some real challenges early on. And when I say early on, and I want to make it clear, this is way before my time, the Lindbergh kidnapping case.
So that was one of the first ones.
I wasn't born, just to be clear at that point.
But you did a thesis on this.
That's right. In graduate school, I studied the Bruno Hauptmann case. He was the handyman, I guess, that was arrested for kidnapping and murdering the Lindbergh child. And that was back in, what, the 1930s, 37, something like that.
Oh, okay, so that's earlier than I thought. Okay.
Right. Maybe a little bit later, but it was a long time ago. And that was the first, really published, I don't know if it was the first televised trial or when I say televised, there might have been cameras in the courtroom, like newsreel cameras, but it was a total corruption of the justice system and the way that was handled. Back then they had these still cameras with the big flash bulbs that would literally explode. They were hot, and then they'd pop them out, and you know, they could start a fire, and those things were popping constantly. The cameras were whirring. You know, they had multiple cameras. And it turned it into a complete unmitigated circus. And, you know, I wasn't there. I didn't really study the facts of the case. But I would say that in this day and age, there would be grounds for appeal, certainly. Unfortunately, I think he didn't get an appeal. He was executed. But
that being said, and let's kind of work that path. And there came a time where I think the standard was that there were no cameras in the...
That's right. And in fact, in that particular case sparked a real movement to make sure this sort of thing didn't happen. People recognized this is not how we want to run journalism and the justice system together, that we can't have this sort of thing. So it was a complete withdrawal of that for many years. I think the next big case was the Billy Saul Estes case in 1962. It was a fraud case, and back then it was high profile, and again that went badly as well. So badly that I think he might have won his case on appeal because of the problems he had or that occurred with the media coverage. Then you fast forward in Florida, and then there was a long lag time where there was nothing again. And then Florida began an experiment in 1977, I believe, with the Ronnie Zamora murder trial. There was a lawyer, and they probably couldn't have ended up, not that they picked him, but they couldn't have ended up with a worse lawyer for the first case to have as an exhibition case, a test during this test period in 77. His name was Ellis Rubin. And Ellis Rubin, who's now passed away, was a very flamboyant, bold, wild defense kind of guy. And you talk about somebody that played for the cameras, that was the guy. Mm-hmm. And he was a real showman. The defense in that case was the TV intoxication defense, where he claimed that this young teenager had been intoxicated by television violence to the point where he didn't really understand right from wrong, and that's why he went to his next-door neighbor, an 82-year-old woman, murdered her, and then went on a spree at Disney World with her money without seeming to have any sort of guilt about it. Didn't work for him, by the way, but that was his defense. And that was the first big show trial in Florida that I, in my research, there might have been some other trial, but that was the one that marks the beginning of the resurgence of cameras in the courtroom in Florida. That experiment, I think, went on for a year. The Supreme Court in Florida decided, well, this isn't such a bad thing. Maybe Ellis Rubin is kind of a dope, and sorry that he had to be center stage there, but it seemed to work out to the point where they said, okay, let's start doing this. So I think it was in 1979 when Ted Bundy, his trial came around, and his was one of the first, maybe the first nationally televised trial, and especially in Florida under the new rules. And as you say, the infamy in that case is that he smiled at the camera, played right to the camera, and that sort of thing. But, did that affect the outcome? Apparently, he wasn't as charming as he thought.
Right. Not to the right people.
Not to the right people.
What do you think has changed over time? And I guess the question I'm asking is, television used to be something where you got an hour's worth of television a week. And then, because there weren't that many networks, there weren't that many shows. And over time, obviously the
now it seems like we have televised trials all the time, and everybody has opinions about it, and there's outrage on both sides.
I don't know if the network still exists that actually does nothing but court TV, and that's what they do.
Yeah, I think they rebranded it, but you're right. I don't think that does exist in that way. But to answer your question, we live in a media-saturated society, as you pointed out. You can turn on the television 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and find somebody ranting or yakking about some current event in the news. The trials are broadcast and covered all over the country. There's no shortage of cameras anywhere. In fact, before I recently retired from News Channel 8, it was fairly common that if something happened spot news-wise, that the video would come in on an iPhone that somebody captured. So my point is, the bottom line to that, as far as cameras in the courtroom, I think people are numb to that. They don't really think too much about it. although that is still a point of debate, and I've debated that vigorously with judges, former chief judge here, who was adamant that we should never show a juror, because if the camera ever pointed toward the jury box and a juror thought he or she was on TV, they would never volunteer to be a juror. And I adamantly disagree with that. I think it's patently false. It perpetuates a myth, and I think that we're a lot more comfortable with cameras.
Has the ability to, I guess, cover a particular trial inside the courtroom, has that changed? Because I know back in the day, you were sitting there with a 16-millimeter big old
right.
camera on your shoulder.
Right.
Actually, probably on a tripod.
On a tripod, exactly. Yeah, and yeah, absolutely. You know, the technology is silent. When that rule went in 1979, there were all sorts of, you know, things that you had to do, like still cameras had to be in a bag to silence the camera because of the single reflex clicking. So it had to either be a camera like a Leica that didn't click, or it had to be in I forget the name of the bag, but it muffled the sound to quiet even the sound of a clicking still camera. Movie cameras, TV cameras, back then they were 16-millimeter cameras. I was part of that, 1979, 1980, I think, was my first camera in the courtroom. And back then, the advice from another colleague is, well, look, when you take your camera into court, open up where the film is, and you have to grease the hub there with some Vaseline. Otherwise, it's going to go squeak, squeak every time you turn it on, and everybody's head will turn. So there was some sensitivity about that. But now it's silent, it's unobtrusive, and in many cases, as you know, cameras are actually built into the courtroom.
Well, I was going to ask you, nowadays, especially in Pinellas County, we actually have cameras in every courtroom.
Right.
Do you all, as reporters, actually go into the courtroom, or is there, because I know there's a room.
It's closed caption,
room.
Though, so do you watch it on the closed caption?
Both. Okay. Closed circuit, it's or both. You know, sometimes we take advantage of those cameras, and we put our own audio in. Sometimes it's a hybrid of the two things. But the bottom line is, when somebody goes, I don't think anybody in this society today, anybody in this room certainly, well, walking into your office, there's nobody there. And next thing you know, a lady appears and, well, how'd you know I was here? And she points to the camera.
Right.
Well, everybody has cameras everywhere. You walk into Walmart before you to buy a bag of potato chips or, a towel or whatever it is you're shopping for. By the time you walk out of Walmart, your image has been captured on probably 52 cameras.
Right, right.
And that's not an exaggeration.
So when you're in a trial, things happen where the media gets kicked out of the courtroom for a minute, whether the judges and the lawyers have to talk about something, or I guess I should say this has happened in federal court more than state court, but there are also I think cases where motions will be filed to have it closed off to the media to have a certain hearing to discuss something with the judge to determine how an undercover witness will be shown or portrayed if they wear a disguise or something like that. How does the media deal with that? Do you try to go, around it and try to figure out what happened? Do you just try to leave it be? Or how do you deal with those types of situations? And have you ever had some kind of motion filed to keep the media out of something you think they should be in on?
Well, in answer to your last question, absolutely. There are motions filed all the time to gag the media, to kick them out, to seal certain documents. And, at Channel 8, the NBC affiliate here has a very vigorous and aggressive history of getting our lawyers in to make sure that the courtrooms stay open. I've been in the awkward situation more times than I'd like to think about of having to stand up in the middle of a court proceeding and object to a motion to either turn off the cameras or not do something that I felt we were entitled to do, and end up in an impromptu basis arguing a motion in front of a judge that I don't really want to argue because I'm not an attorney, but I know what the basic rules are. And in some cases, I'm proud to say that I have made valid and legitimate arguments, and the judge retired from the bench to go research it, extremely angry that I was, being a problem child by trying to keep something open that they wanted closed. And then this one case, the judge came back and said, well, Mr. Douglas, you are absolutely correct. You do, in fact, have a right to be here. You have a right to show the jury. Everything you say is legally upheld. However, I don't like it a bit. So I'm going to take your camera out of the jury box for the moment, and I'm going to put you back in the most obscure corner I can, and I'm going to do everything else I can to make it make your life difficult, because I don't like you and I don't like what you did, even though that is the rule of law. So I've been in that awkward situation, but again, I'm not arguing on my behalf.
Right.
I'm arguing on behalf of all those people that can't fit into the courtroom and have other things to do, and you know, to give them access,
the public.
Right. And I will say, one of the source, probably the most controversial thing of late that I've dealt with for the last 5 years, is the aspect of whether or not we are allowed to or going to show jury members. And I am adamant that anything in that courtroom is fair game. And one of the reasons is, somebody sitting at home might say, you know, juror number three, I know that person, and that's the second cousin of the defendant.
Well, and that's an interesting kind of debate, because they also don't get to see how not representative it is of our client a lot of times. So it can look
jury of your peers,
and sometimes it's far from the peers of our client.
And there are also times when jurors misbehave in some way.
Sure, fall asleep.
Right. Exactly. Or maybe they're making bedroom eyes at the, you know, either one of you guys, because you're such good-looking guys, or, you know.
We like those jurors.
Maybe it's the prosecutor, or, you know, who knows what kind of craziness. George.
Accountability.
Exactly. George Steinbrenner's son was on the voir dire panel that was being interviewed by the lawyers in the Henry Lyons case, which was a really high-profile case. And at that time, the judge, we were under a mandate not to identify any of the jurors. And at that point, I was just going along with it. This is many years ago. And when George Steinbrenner's son sat there and said, you know, people like me, I don't want to serve on this jury because people like me shouldn't have to serve on juries. You know, I'm too busy. I'm too important. You know, I thought, well, the heck with the judge's gag order. I'm identifying this potential juror as George Steinbrenner's son, because he just committed news here. You know, this is newsworthy, and I'm not going to gag myself over something like this just because the judge doesn't want to put a chilling effect on, or what they think is going to be a chilling effect on the jury selection.
I wanted to, before we finish, more about Oscar Ray Boland.
Sure.
So let's get into any fun facts about the case. You know, what it was 30 years you were covering it, right?
Sure.
So anything happened either during the investigative portion, during the trial, anything?
Well, you know, this is one of those cases that was fraught with imperfections, legally speaking. You know, you had witnesses that had died, critical witnesses. I think a wife, his wife who he'd confessed to. And that's always tricky, you know, when the spousal thing
privilege.
But she basically threw him under the bus, but her testimony was being replayed after death. And so I think as a consequence, I believe he had three victims that they prosecuted him for, and maybe 9 murder trials. I think he was retried. He was tried 3 times in each one of those cases. So frankly, it was, as a reporter, it was like 2 sticks in the eye. It was like Groundhog Day, like, oh my gosh, I get to hear this all over again, to the point where you could memorize it. But I will say that in that case, when you're asking for strange things that happen, it was televised because he was a serial killer, and it was a high-profile case, very tragic and emotional for the community. But at one point, a member of the defense team who was supposedly happily married to a, you know, silk stocking lawyer in Tampa, falls in love with Oscar Ray Boland, the alleged serial killer, and that soap opera became central to the case, because it was unfolding in the middle of the trial, and I happened to uncover, you know, the relationship and prove it out. And even though it had nothing to do whether Oscar Ray Boland was guilty or innocent, it was fundamentally part of that case.
Right.
And you know, unfortunately, it added to the circus-like atmosphere that sometimes surrounds these high-profile cases. But, you know, it is what it is. It's not for me to say, well, I have to make this case boring so that the justice system will not be perverted in any way. You know, it's my job to make it interesting. She made it really interesting by, you know, ending up marrying Oscar Ray Boland, before his conviction, and was in love with him to the day he was executed at the Florida State Prison, which I witnessed.
So when you have cases like this that have multiple trials that you get to see, do you notice differences in them? Do some witnesses get, you know, a question in the first trial, not in the second, or things like that? Does anything big different happen in these trials?
You know, in that case, there were some fundamental witnesses that the prosecutors didn't want to give up on, like the deceased wife. I think everybody adjusts. They know what went well during the last trial, and you know, maybe they won't do that. The defense, I think, adjusts. The prosecution adjusts. So you see definitely some movement there. But you know, getting back to the fundamental question, I don't think now some lawyers tell me that when they know they're going to be on television or a camera's going to be, they prepare much better because they want to be sharp in front of the camera. I think that probably does happen. I don't think anybody does things that are untoward or that somehow corrupt the justice system because there's a camera in the courtroom. In fact, there was science to back up the point that when people are on camera, when there's a camera pointing at them and they're telling a story in court, that they tend to be more truthful because they think the camera is a lie detector.
Sure.
So I think there's a very positive outcome to it, negligible downside.
So in Oscar Ray Boland's case, did you ever get an opportunity to interview him?
I did not.
Okay.
No.
Do you know if he ever, because I know in a lot of these serial killer cases, sometimes they'll get interviewed by the FBI or somebody afterwards to try to see if they committed more crimes, if they admit to more crimes, or go into their database or anything like that. Did anything happen at the end of his case like that?
I don't think he ever did, because I think he was going for innocent, I think, right to the very end.
Okay.
Rosalie Martinez, who he ultimately married, she divorced her husband, married him. She cooperated greatly with, ABC, the network. And when she married him over the telephone, that was on, you know, whatever documentary or
right,
whatever news show that ABC had on. So I think she was playing for the... In fact, when she was thrown out of the courtroom when I was... After I exposed the fact that she was having a virtual affair with Oscar Ray Boland and leaving her husband to be with him, as much as she could be with a guy that's, you know, behind bars, she was literally thrown out of the courtroom for making eyes at him in the courtroom and different things, inappropriate behavior. She came into the closet that we had as a media room and told me that I had to leave because there wasn't room for both of us. And I explained to her this was the media room and she was the guest. But she was talking about a movie and who was going to play her and who was going to play Oscar Ray. And she even had an actor picked out for me who was Danny DeVito, which I, you know, I like Danny DeVito.
Sure.
I'm not sure that our characters are the same. But
yeah, but what is it about serial killers that just brings the absolute crazy out in everybody?
You know, I would love to sit down with Rosalie, even though to this day she probably despises me, but... I would love to sit down with her, and I thought about that earlier today. What is it about this guy that attracted you? What is it about any serial killer that attracts these women that you know, start these jailhouse romances? Is it the idea that you're
so
safe?
Much more than you would think.
Oh, it happens all the time. You know, pen pals and romance.
It makes no sense.
And maybe it's the safety, the fact that, you know, I can love this guy and communicate with him, and we can exchange terms of affection. But I'll never really have to live the reality with him. It's a safe kind of being safe. But, you know, I've met a number of killers over time, and some of them are very kind to me and very polite and genteel. But they're sociopaths. I had one guy, Robert Temple, who was convicted of murdering Rosemary Christensen, the realtor that disappeared for 9 years until his girlfriend led authorities to an unmarked grave on the Suwannee River, and then it all kind of fell apart. You know, he called me up. This would have driven you guys crazy if you were his lawyers, but he called me up a week before his murder trial. He was representing himself, by the way.
Which also happens a lot.
Yeah, not advisable in my
right.
book. But he was representing himself, and he sent me a letter a week before and said, hey, you know, I'd interviewed him a year before that, and he hated me after the interview, but invited me to come by and interview him again. And he would spill the beans on a lot of stuff. So I went down, and at the end of that interview, And I was thoroughly convinced that, based on the evidence and what I knew, that he was a killer, that he had, in fact, killed his wife. He admitted to hiding the body and trying to cover it up, but he blamed it on his girlfriend. She said it was him. But, you know, at the end of the interview, he was very polite, and I remember saying to him, now let me get this straight. You're saying that you freely admit that you went to Walmart, you bought a tote, you stuffed your wife in the tote, you put her favorite pillow on top, you closed it up, you drove to the Suwannee River, you dug a grave, you tossed her in upside down, but you had nothing to do with murdering your wife? I don't understand that. And he said, well, I loved her too much to put her in a garbage can. Wow. I mean, these people do not think the same way we do. Serial killers. In his case, he wasn't a serial killer, although he did have a previous murder charge. But like Oba Chandler, for example, there's another case that I covered, and I also witnessed his execution. And Oba Chandler never admitted to murdering those poor women who were going to be featured in a St. Pete Times or Tampa Bay Times reprisal of that Pulitzer Prize-winning story, Angels and Demons, fairly soon. There's an anniversary coming up. But he never admitted that. And even in the death chamber, when I was sitting there and they said, do you have any final words, which is, to me, it's kind of macabre, but it's one of the most fascinating things I can think. Like, what would I say, what would you say as your final words on earth? He had nothing to say, which is disappointing because you want to hear something. But when we went back to the media tent after the execution, they handed out a piece of paper with a note scribbled on it in handwriting on yellow paper, copied, and it said, you're killing an innocent man today. And I remember saying out loud, who wrote this? And then I realized immediately, I know who wrote this, Oba Chandler. He signed it, but it was in his handwriting. And if you remember that case, it was his handwriting that sent him to the death chamber when somebody matched the handwriting of a note left in the car and somehow. But my point is, here's a guy who was absolutely, unequivocally guilty of a triple murder, and yet right to the point where he died, completely denied any culpability in that, even though all the evidence was crystal clear and there was nothing, to me, not one shred of doubt in that case. Some of these cases, there's reasonable doubt. Some of them, you know, you could make a case the other way. There have been podcasts that have been created about cases like that. Not this one. And yet, you know, right to his deathbed, he was not admitting to it. And he's not the only one like that.
Yeah, so I think that's also interesting when talking about these kinds of cases, how there are a lot of similarities in some of them, but then some of them are completely different. How they, you know, start, the middle, and the end can be totally different. Some of them deny it till the end. Some of them are like, yeah, okay, I'm guilty of that, plus these other 25 murders that you guys don't even know that I had anything to do with.
Sure.
Let me ask you a question, since it just came to my mind. Our FBI agent who handled, obviously, a pretty big serial killer case many years ago indicated that when kind of the news broke about what was going on, there was obviously somebody targeting a specific victim. The floodgates opened up and every loon bag within a three-state area was calling up and saying, yep, I did that, that's me. Have you ever had anybody that, while you're reporting on a case, on a murder, for example, or killings that an arrest had not yet happened, did anybody ever contact you and say, hey, this is me, I did this, and then you talk to me and realize, God, this guy's crazy?
Not exactly, although I have had people call me up and say that they've overheard, you know, plots in a bar against the president's life and, you know, don't bother calling the chief, you know, the special agent in charge with the Secret Service, agent so-and-so, because they already heard this story. And turns out the guy was
crazy.
He was crazy. He was mentally ill. And when I called the special agent, he goes, oh, yeah, well, he's off his meds again. So there have been people like that. Nobody has actually falsely confessed to me, although I have handled some cases where people called up to turn themselves into me who were killers, and they were afraid that the police would kill them unless there was a media witness. They were paranoid to the point where they just thought they'd done something so terrible that they would never make it to the jail.
Did you participate in those?
Oh, yes, I did.
Okay, so you showed up and helped facilitate the turn-in, if that's what you would do?
I did facilitate it, and, you know, it was a little scary, you know, frankly. But, yeah. And again, you know, there's another case of working with law enforcement, but not as an agent of law enforcement, but, you know, as a journalist and a good citizen to bring about, you know, what everybody I think would agree would be a good outcome, which is the apprehension of a fugitive who can later
sure.
face trial and have their guilt or innocence sorted out in that realm.
Well, awesome, Mark. Thank you so much for doing this with us today. We really enjoyed it. And I'd like to have him on for something else if we can, if something else
sure.
comes up.
Keep up the great work because, you know, not everybody gets to go to law school. There's so many misunderstandings in the
sure.
law, and the more you folks can do to sort out some of the mythology, I think the better off everybody will be. And it's a great service you're doing, so keep it up.
Appreciate
it. And you keep holding the powerful accountable.
I will try. Even in retirement, I'm trying to do that.
Good deal.
So,
all right, thanks a lot.
Thank you.